So you slept here in Cape Town?
No.
Or you're staying here in Cape Town?
No,
in Gauteng. Oh, I'm also from Gauteng. Okay. Thank you, Nelipa. There's a bottle of water there. Nelipa, it's a little bit. I'm not even going to recommend. Relax. Just be free and feel homely. You have all these wonderful honorable members. They are not going to fight with you. All what they want from you is answers when they ask you questions. And anything else, if they fight with you, I'm here to protect you and defend you. So rest assured. My name is Nonhlanhla Ncube-Ndaba. I'm the chairperson of this ad hoc committee. I'm with my staff members for the committee. On my left-hand side, I have Nelly Saul, the committee secretary. On my right-hand side, I have Tembeka, who's my timekeeper. So, you have only 25 minutes to respond to your questions. And we have 20 minutes to ask you questions. So, all in all, you'll be here with us for 45 minutes. I think it's enough, ne? There's much time, yeah. And we also have our media people here. And you know, most of you are live. So people there are watching you. But I trust you that, you'll be able not to disappoint the people of South Africa because they are watching you. Yeah, and now I'll now give honorable members a chance to introduce themselves. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Dr. Pravina. Pravina Krajelik. Am I pronouncing
the
word?
Yeah, it's Ila.
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 Okay.
My name is Rosalia Storim Rutla. I'm a member of this committee.
Good afternoon, Doctor. My name is Thabo Manyoni. I'm part of this committee.
Good afternoon, Doctor. I'm Joyce Witumelo Maluleke, member of this committee.
Tabona Ilai. My name is Nokone Simajeke, member of this committee. Thank you.
Some of us will pronounce you in Xhosa. You see, you say Ila,
yeah.
Eli, and then you say Eli.
Yeah.
So don't mind it.
No,
oh, okay. So Kaula can say Ela.
Everything goes.
Everything goes. So one of the Ela. Kaula, remember the comment in your
Dr. Sukraj Eli, my name is Pinky Kikam. I'm a member of this committee.
Sawubona, Dr. Sukraj Eli. My name is Terry Stander, and I am a member of the committee.
You must tell her that you're not Kolo, too.
Kolo. Sihlalo wam. Kini gamgu no Kolo. All the time.
Okay.
God was just a nickname. Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Sakuj Eli. My name is Nomsa Machezi, and I'm the member of this committee.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Wilma Neodruchen. I'm deaf, and I use a South African Sign Language interpreter. So the voice that you hear is my sign language interpreter, Trudy Tennyson. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome. I'm a member of this committee, Sherilyn Dudley.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sorry, can I just say at the outset, I am totally blind. So because you are using mic, sometimes I might not exactly know which direction to look at.
Okay.
So just excuse me for the eye contact, because I'm not going to be making any eye contact with you.
Okay, thank you, my darling. So we'll switch on your mic. It will stay on.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll also remind you with time, because you'll have to respond for each question in 3 minutes. But feel free to respond and give us as much information as you can. For as long as you are within your 25 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. My first question is about why do you think you are the best candidate for this post? And tell us about yourself.
Okay. Let's just say at the outset that I, being a woman myself, firstly, and being a woman who has suffered discrimination in the past and being previously disadvantaged and having to fight for everything that I have currently achieved, I think being able to be in this position, if you've experienced something firsthand, it very often helps you to fight the fight. I have, as I said to you, I was born in KZN, and at the age of 3 years and 9 months, I was forced to go to a school about 150 kilometers away from my home for blind Indian children at the time. And I was basically torn away from my home because that was the only available education that I could have. Obviously, it was in a special segregated sort of school, but at least I still had some education compared to other people in my position. I was born partially sighted. I had 10% vision in my one eye, but at the age of 12, I lost all my sight completely. So I then had to make that transition of learning how to be a teenage girl, making all of those changes, you know, learning Braille, how to walk with a cane, simple things, your whole self-esteem, your self-worth, self-image. And thereafter, I moved on and I went to university after matriculating with 4 A's and 2 B's, despite being blind and writing the same examination as everybody else. But I had to be determined and fight. And I must say as well, I came from a sort of working class background. So I had a lot of my family and my parents basically supported me to get to university, where I managed to get bursaries and I got my social science degree, where I majored in political science and legal studies. I then went on further and I did my law degree, and I got my LLB degree thereafter. I then did a master's in political science, which I got cum laude, and then I did my PhD in public policy. So all of these academic qualifications that I had, I worked very hard, because being a blind person in university, where you got no resources and you're struggling and all of that, it was a real struggle, but I persevered and I worked hard and I managed to get where I did. And I thereafter went to the Durban Bar, where I practiced as an advocate in court for about 4 years. And I then went to the Law Reform Commission, where I was instrumental in drafting the bill on contact and care, which then became the Children's Act. And so we looked at very much of the contact and care for fathers, and also for mothers, and how the maintenance, all of those things, where I was instrumental in working on those things. I then moved on to working as a senior state advocate at the Department of Justice, where I represented the ministers when they were suing or being sued. So I was in court, did a lot of court work for the state for the next 5 years. And now, my current position, I am with the Department of Justice, and I'm a director within the Chief Directorate Promotion of the Rights of Vulnerable Groups, which focuses on women, children, older persons, and people with disabilities. So for that reason, and moreover, I was very involved also in various NGOs. Whether it was with women's rights, children's rights, people with disabilities, I'm advocating, I fight the fight, despite the fact that now I'm in government. We continuously have to advocate to ensure that we're able to uphold our constitution, and I've been doing that. And therefore, all of that taken into consideration, and I've also been presenting papers nationally, internationally, I think I have adequate academic and social experience to be able to hold this role as a commissioner in the commission.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, honorable members are going to ask you questions. Ma'am Story, Honorable Macheke, Honorable Velma, Honorable Nomsa, Honorable Kikan. Each member, after he or she has asked you a question, you'll have to respond.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll just call them by name, and then they'll ask you a question, and then you'll respond. Okay.
Yeah, I've already prepared you, Dr. Crash, you make me very jealous to have acquired all the degrees and everything so young. I feel like going back. Yes. But that is good for the country. I just want to know, you seem to be a very much concerned person. You know, and I know that you are informed about all most of the laws that we have, and you also understand the mandate of the CGE. I wanted to know from you, what do you think we lack from the CGE in terms of monitoring and making follow-ups on the legislations that we have passed for gender equality, and also the international protocols that South Africa has ratified? Are we doing justice to what we are supposed to be doing as a country? There are so many things that we are concerned about. Also, customary laws, and most of the things that we are supposed to be. Now we are on sustainable development goals, and we are talking about all the goals that are there. Can you just, in a brief answer, tell us what you think? Where are we? As the CGE, are we doing justice to what we're supposed to be doing?
I think you are doing justice with the current resources that you have. I think we clearly need more, we need to be seen more, because you know they say justice must be done, but more importantly, justice must be seen to be done. So I think, you know, people want to see that the watchdog is watching, put it that way. And I think the more we take, we are seen to be doing what we're doing, I think very often we're actually doing a lot of monitoring. We are in partnership, you know, but the problem is it's not people, the society doesn't know or the extent of the work that we are doing, and how we are monitoring and what we're doing on a daily sort of basis. I think if you're not directly involved with looking at gender equality and the balance, etc., you know, the CGE will fly under your radar, so to speak. And I think when it comes to the legislation side of things, I think currently we have very good legislation. I think we've done well to the extent that we have gender mainstreamed when you're looking at PERPUDA, the Employment Equity Act, the BBBE code. We try, and when we're looking at legislation, it's there. The problem, what we need to try and follow up on, is to try and do a regulatory impact assessment to see how is all of this legislation that's in place, what sort of impact is it making on our people, on ensuring that we have equality and equity and, you know, reduce gender-based violence. What is impacting the fabric of our society that we are actually struggling with implementing this legislation, that is actually translates from legislation and policy into practice, that people can come to our courts and be able to enforce their rights. I think we've got this beautiful constitution. It's the most, one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. And I think what we've got, the legislative framework is there. And I think the mandate of the CGE to monitor, to do its investigations, to lobby, to educate, and I think that is the for me the most important thing with how we are going to ensure that we actually implement legislation, is to educate people on how to enforce their rights and how to enforce their rights. And also to become empowered people who, after they go to court, all of a sudden don't pull back and don't want to use the system anymore. Or it's about that public education that needs to be, and it's not only for the people on the ground, even our leaders. And I was reading in the media of the king in the Eastern Cape who was saying that we can never have a woman president. If people in such positions are saying such things, I mean, those are, we need to be able to penetrate through that to create that education so that our legislation works for us. There's no point in having the legislation that's there and it doesn't work for us. And I think that's the problem with our legislation, is looking at the impact and the enforcement. Insofar as our international protocols are concerned, I mean, I was reading the annual report of the CGE, and clearly it's a very in-depth, very... it's very comprehensive, and I can see that a lot of work has been done. And insofar as FEDA and the Beijing Platform of Action and the various African charters that we are aligned to, I think insofar as reporting is concerned, I think we are able, there's enough for us to report on, and I think we are able to do that as effectively as most countries in the world anyway. So, I mean, I'm very involved now currently, and I've only been involved in disability law for the past 3 years or so, but I've been to the committee for, the UN Committee for the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which obviously cuts across women and girls and older persons, etc. And I've also been instrumental not only in the country report and guiding the committee, but also on shadow reporting, which I think is vital. We need to be able to ensure that not only are we monitoring, but our various partners in the NGO sector, etc., are encouraged to do shadow reports to show what has been happening, what, you know, with regard to gender equality and equity.
Okay. Mama, take it.
Thank you, Chairperson, Dr. Sabina. My question is as follows. Let's say you become a commissioner. How would you plan to lead the commission ethically for sustainability in terms of economy, environment, and society, taking into account impact on internal and external stakeholder?
I think for me the key thing that I would focus on is looking at how we can forge partnerships. I would look at networking, look at collaborating, not only with the various government departments, but also with your private sector, your NGOs, ensuring that everyone, this becomes, it's owned by everyone, so that we can actually ensure that what we are doing is economically viable and sustainable. Ethically, I think we know what our mandate is for the Commission for Gender Equality. Our role is to monitor. And you know what? Quite honestly, criticism is great if it's constructive criticism. And we as the CGE need to be able to look at what we have in place and to be able to say, listen, yes, we're obviously not going to be perfect. You know, change doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. Quite honestly, we are going to be having to advocate for years to come in order for this balance to actually occur. Because this is entrenched, stereotypes which results in stigma, prejudice, and discrimination. It happens. And therefore, we need to be able to say, listen, these things are going to happen. We don't live in a perfect world. And when we criticize, it's not to pick on people, but we're constructively criticizing to say, let's come together, work together to try and sort this out so we actually have, we live according to the spirit and ethos of our constitution.
Okay.
Thank you.
Honorable Velma.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for being here in the interview. I am also applauding to all the qualifications that you have, and as a person with a disability, you know, sometimes many people do not achieve what you have been achieving so far, and congratulations on that. What I want to ask is, in relation to the disabled girl child and disabled woman, is enough done to protect people with disabilities? Now, if you are appointed as a counselor on the commission, what more can be done for women and the girl child with disabilities? To give you an example, last week in the news, a girl was raped, and it was a deaf child that was raped, and that happened 2 years ago. Now, it was brought to court, but because the prosecutor didn't understand sign language, they threw it out of court. And obviously the parents were upset about that because they don't know what's going to be done about it. Now, you also sit on the Justice Department. And, you know, with that role, and as a commissioner, what will you do to make sure, to ensure that disability is not thrown out or neglected so that such things do not happen? Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that question. I was actually hoping somebody asked me that question. I'm very, very passionate about disability, being a person with a disability myself. And as I said to you, I used to be a state advocate, senior state advocate for the state. However, once I had my baby in 2013, I wanted to be more office-based, number one. And number two, I saw that nothing was being done in the department for persons with disabilities, for injustice. So I decided to transfer from in-house counsel to the role of director persons with disabilities within vulnerable groups, so that something actually got done for children, women, older persons with disabilities. And what I initiated, it is my brainchild, I had a national roundtable where I invited persons with disabilities from all, with various different disabilities, because disability is diverse. I invited everyone to a roundtable where we sat and we looked at all the challenges that are currently faced by persons with disabilities in our country, insofar as their rights are protected. And what we then did was, we said, we highlighted the challenges and we had recommendations. It was a 2-day national roundtable, well attended. After that, I organized an intersectoral committee of about 40 people, which I chaired. There, across the spectrum, people from the NGO sector, government, private sector, etc. And we put together, I was instrumental lead drafter, because I'm the only person in the directorate, it's me, I'm the director for persons with disability, I report to myself, I do everything, because there's no one else in the department doing it. I then drafted a best practice court services model, which is currently hopefully going to be approved, finalized, and going to be promulgated as a code under PEPEDA, the Promotion of Equality Act, to ensure that when persons with disabilities go to court, that they actually have reasonable accommodations. Like you're saying, if girls who are deaf are raped, they must be able to have, if any person who is deaf has to go to court, they must have a sign language interpreter, and not only must they have a sign language interpreter, they must have a sign language interpreter that can actually speak that their particular language, their dialect. Okay, so it goes beyond that. And when you look at persons who have intellectual and psychosocial disabilities, they must have intermediaries to assist them. They need to be able to have or whatever reasonable accommodations that they need to be able to testify. And remember, we have a broader, it's not only the Department of Justice. When people go to the police station with disabilities, they are the first point of entry, and if the police don't take them seriously, it will never even reach the prosecutor. So I'm looking at that broad, we're looking at it broadly. We're also looking at, for example, if somebody is raped who is blind, how do they identify the perpetrator? And people are forced to go for identification parade. If you didn't see the perpetrator, then clearly it's thrown out of court because it lacks probative value, your evidence. Mm-hmm. So all of that, I am very committed to persons with disabilities, women with disabilities, girls with disabilities. And I belong, I'm the first vice president, I've been elected as the first vice president of the International Council for the Education of People with Visual Impairment, Deaf, Blind, Multiple Disabilities. My focus is to ensure that girls with disabilities, children with disabilities, actually go to school, get enrolled, and are given quality education. And we, South Africa, and it's actually across the world, that we, and Africa, my focus, I'm the principal officer for Africa, so that is one of my key areas as well, because I believe that the cornerstone and the platform is education. If our children and our girls are not educated, they will not be employed. That leads to the fact that they will not be economically empowered, which then leads to the circle of domestic violence, sexual offences, etc., etc. And I mean, the fact of the matter is our people with disabilities, aside from having the compounded marginalization of being disabled, many of them are living in rural areas. We've got the cultural aspect, and when you have a disability, it's compounded marginalization. So extra care, extra advocacy, extra, everything has to be done tenfold more than what is being done for persons without disabilities. Sorry if I'm coming across too passionately, but yes, thank you.
No.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Eli, for giving us an opportunity to interview you. I just want to tell you that, you know, CG is a very, very small budget of 67 million. And I can see that you're very ambitious, so I'm just wondering, with a small budget, you know, should you be a commissioner, how would you feel about that? But anyway, my question is basically, disability is underrepresented in government institutions, and cannot even talk about it in the private sector. What would you do from a justice background to mainstream disability at government institutions? And also, you mentioned in your CV that you proposed that your ICT experience, you use that as a, basically you are a forum chairperson, that could actually, you can use that forum to assist practical development of women, especially in the rural areas of South Africa. How would you do that? And also the third one is your view on the present gender machinery in government. Is there a room for improvement? Thank you.
Okay. Let me start with the first question, and if I forget your other two, you can just remind me. With regard to ensuring that disability is mainstreamed, I think first and foremost we need to educate all our government departments on what is disability mainstreaming. Because quite honestly, people talk about disability mainstreaming, but they have no clue about what it is. Disability mainstreaming means that every department doesn't have to have one little desk that deals with everything regarding persons with disabilities, whether it has to do with HR, facilities, supply chain. If everything, as soon as it's a disability issue, it goes to one person. That is not disability mainstreaming. So when you see, we've got a disability focal point. You know what? I don't want to hear about disability focal point. I want to know that your disability focal point is basically coordinating and reporting on what your various branches in your particular departments are doing. And basically, for example, let me use the Department of Justice. I basically, when I came into to this role of disability, which was in January 2015, I ensured, I said to them, listen, you need to have disability in court services, you need to have disability in supply chain, so that when people with disabilities want to become entrepreneurs and want to provide you with services, you need to ensure that they are on your database. Because if they're not on your database, they can't provide you with a service. Then you go further, you go to Justice College. In fact, our current Justice College does not have a training on sensitizing court officials on disabilities. I, as a person who's a lawyer, I'm not a disability expert. The only thing I know about disability and why I'm involved in disability is because I'm a person with a disability and it interested me, and I figured if no one else was going to do it, I had to do it. I wrote an information booklet to hand out to staff within the Department of Justice about disability, the challenges, etc. And I trained 1,000 staff of the Department of Justice myself, although I'm not a lecturer, but I did it. And I think that is how we need to educate the various departments on how to mainstream. As I did it in Justice, it would need to be done in all the different departments to ensure that disability is represented in the various directors in the department. That's the only way every sector is going to be included. And that is how we're going to bring about inclusion of disability. The second question about the ICT. We're living in a technological age. Everything technology is such an empowering tool, not only for women in general, but also for persons with disabilities and women with disabilities, etc. Because without my voice software on my computer, I would never be where I am today. Without being able to read Braille, without Braille printers and scanners, etc., etc., I wouldn't be where I am today. Similarly, persons who are deaf, persons who are physically challenged, who can't even pick up a book, if they didn't have access to technology, we would not be where we are. I'm actually the chairperson of the Disability Chamber of the ICT Forum. That forum was established by the Minister of the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services. I actually am not an expert in IT. I have no idea why the Minister thought that I would be the best person to be the chair of the Disability ICT Forum. However, when I took it on, I was quite afraid about why I was actually doing it and whether I would be the right person to do it. However, the Chamber has excelled in its work in the past 2 years. We have ensured that we are able to have an emergency call center for persons who are deaf, who could not, when they had an emergency, they could never get in touch with emergency services before because they could never communicate. We ensure that we now have accessible websites so that people can actually have access to information. We've got a broadband policy to ensure that women, even in rural areas, actually are able to access the internet, which was never done before. So I think we've made vast inroads insofar as that is concerned. What was your third question?
What is your view of the present gender machinery in government institutions, and is there room for improvement?
I think I think we were very wise in ensuring that we had the Office on the Status of Women in the Presidency, and similarly now with us having the Commission for Gender Equality in terms of Section 187 of the Constitution. However, as we say, you even spoke about it just now about your budget. You have limited resources, you undercapacitated. I think, you know what, quite honestly, if we want our gender machinery to work, we need to ensure that we have the relevant resources to be able to do the work. The whole thing, you know, people start looking down upon you as an institution if you keep on, if your bite is softer than your bark, put it that way. So I think insofar as that is concerned, you need to try and lobby to ensure that you get more money. You said about improvement in your second part of that question.
Is there room for improvement?
Oh yes, definitely. There's always room for improvement. We can never ever reach the point of saying we have arrived. As much as we have arrived, unfortunately, we still have to we are in an infant stage. We still have many, we have tons of work that still needs to be done. Whether we as the gender machinery, the Office of the Status of Women, and all the government departments as well, have to be able to come to the party and ensure that they're committed to be able to work towards gender mainstreaming. And your question about the budget and whether I'm very ambitious and whether I would actually fit as a commissioner, I mean, I currently work for the Department of Justice, where we earn very nominal salaries as well. So I don't think it would be very big much of a difference.
Doctor, you have done extensive work on public policy through your research work and your PhD. And from where you're sitting, do you think the public sector and the private sector are adequately resourcing programs for people living with disabilities, including their empowerment into the mainstream of the economy? Is there any impact, or do you think there are areas where we have to improve? Because I'll tell you why. When the preferential procurement policy started, there was malicious compliance by many companies ticking boxes. In my company, yes, I have women, you tick. In my company, yes, I have a disabled person. But if you look at real empowerment, it never translated into that real empowerment. It was like, and even in those days when it started, many people were not even aware they are part of these companies. Some were not even aware that there are dividends that have to be declared and all those kind of things. Are we improving along those lines? Do you think ever since we brought in all these empowerment policies, from the disability side, is there improvement? Is there impact? Or there's room for improvement?
Okay. I'm going to have to say we have done a lot, yet it still feels like we've done nothing. Okay? I just want to say to you, people speak about people with disabilities as one homogenous group of people. We are so diverse in our challenges that we experience, in our needs, okay? And, I am fortunate. I am blind. However, I have all my faculties. I was able to be educated. Thankfully, God blessed me with a little bit of brain power. But what I'm saying is I was given that opportunity to be where I am. Unfortunately, we get people who have multiple disabilities, okay? They don't only have the challenge I have, they have much more challenges than I have. And what you find is that people like employers, like people with the BEE, etc., they only want to employ people with mild disabilities. People like myself and people who are deaf, people who have intellectual disabilities, we fall by the wayside because there's too many reasonable accommodations that is required. People see us as a burden, unfortunately. It's because of the myths that existed from the past that we were a charity case, okay? And the fact that these stereotypes exist. And once the myths and the stereotypes exist, it's very difficult to try and remove it. And with that stereotype comes the stigma and the prejudice, etc. And currently, you would find people, as you're saying, employers, they say they employ the person with a disability, but it's someone that probably, they needed to probably put in a ramp, maybe, or they disqualified as disabled, so they tick the relevant box. But they don't know what it means. to accommodate a person with a disability. When it comes to even you looking at the skills development, you find companies want to quickly, we've got this learnership, we're going to give people 2,000 rand a month, 3,000 rand a month stipend. After 2 years, the person doesn't get a job again. It's just learnership upon learnership, so that they are ticking the relevant boxes. And I think the most important part where we are falling short is the fact that we don't have inclusive education. Mm-hmm. Our children have to go to special schools where they're not getting a quality education. Some of the advantaged special schools are getting quality education. All our other children are either out of school or not getting a quality education. And if you don't have a quality education, you cannot go to tertiary education, or let alone if your field is not in academia but vocational, you're not getting that particular opportunity. And then you're getting the thing where people are giving money, we're going to do rural development, we want to do bead making for persons with disabilities. Take all of these beads, go dump it at the per place. Thereafter, there's no follow-up to ensure that there's sustainability. How are these people going to sell these, whatever they're doing? Who's going to train them? It goes far beyond from just going and buying these and telling people, getting money, NGOs and SMEs and whatever you want to call them. They use people with disabilities to get money, to say they're doing projects, but they don't carry it through to ensure that empowerment actually translates into practice. So we are falling far short of it. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And quite honestly, disability is cross-cutting. It goes from women to older persons to children and men. It goes across the board. And people fail to realize that we're not only dealing with the 10% or 15% or whatever it is of people that we're looking at. It's far broader than that.
Thank you very much. Oh, Honorable Kaula.
Ngiyabonga sihlalo. Eyi, noma sengitoboze nje ngiphatha kambe ekhuluma. Yabo nje bekhuluma ngalezi zinto lezi azithintayo. Into esiyi-raise njalo e-committee ukuthi abantu besifazane bayenza imisebenzi kodwa akekho uthatha imisebenzi yabo idayisa. Ngiyabonga ukhulu enkosazane. So mina okwami-ke nje umbuzo uthi njengoba kunalabantu ababizwa ngama-brain laba abahwaya kanje amaphepha mabekhuluma abangabona kungenzeka kanjani ukuthi ezikoleni lezi mpela zabantu nakhona kufunde la ma-language le-brain ngoba i-sign language already yona sishiye ukuthi ayifunde noma sekukhona iy'kole ezifuna eseyifunda ngishiso ukuthi lokho umntwana okhubazekile uzalwa abantu abasuke bephila mhlawumbe bengakhubazekile noma futhi ephila emphakathini nabantu ukuze angakhuli yena esebona eseseceleni ukuze akwazi ukuthi amukeleke egcekeni ngoba sibayifunda lento isikhathi esithi siyobabeka lapho yini esingayenza nathi la ma-language njengale brain nje nayo ifundo ezikoleni. Ngiyabonga noma befuna ukudlala nabanye akwazi la ayibona ekhululekile. Ngiyabonga.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm touched by what you're saying about the work that is done by the physically or the blind people, whereby when they do their work with the beads, at the end of the day, find that you know what they are doing is not taken into consideration. They are only used for commercial purposes. But nonetheless, what I want to know is, what is it that you're going to do in order to make sure that braille is learned in the school, same as the sign language, since it has already been pronounced that sign language should be taught in schools. Why am I saying this? Because you know, a child who is born with impairment, you find that that child is born by, if I may say, normal parents. But now this child grows up in an environment where there are other people that are normal. I therefore feel that this child should be accommodated, because this child grows in an environment where there are people who are, one say, they are normal. Now this child should not be excluded or be taken to schools of which are called special schools. This child must go in an environment where everybody is normal. Therefore, my emphasis is, what is it that you are going to do in order to make sure that Braille is learned at school? Thank you very much.
I am actually currently already involved in trying to ensure that children learn Braille in their schools, that they are actually getting their textbooks in Braille, because unfortunately the current situation of our children, both in special schools and mainstream schools, is that they are currently not learning Braille, they're not getting their textbooks in Braille, and most importantly, the teachers in the special schools even don't know Braille. Now, as I said to you, I am the first vice president of the International Council for Education of Persons with Visual Impairment. The reason why I was appointed in this international role was because of my doctorate is on public policy for inclusive education of learners who are visually impaired. So my research for my doctorate was to ensure that learners who are blind, visually impaired, multiply disabled, actually receive the educational support that they need when they go to school. And Braille, sign language, etc., is one of the things that they need to learn. So I have created, I'm actually a lead in the forum. It's an education forum that has been created, spanning from the various special schools, including mainstream schools, the Department of Education itself, the Provincial Department of Education. I was instrumental in organizing seminars about 3 weeks ago, where I invited the international people to actually come to our school, a school in Pretoria, for the blind, where we invited various stakeholders to say and to tell the Department of Education how important Braille is in the life of a child. A pen, what a pen is to a sighted child, is what a Perkins Brailler and a book is to a blind child. And without that page and a book and pen in their hand, can you imagine what will become of a child? As I said, a few of us over the years have been lucky to get the Braille and go to school where we actually were taught sign language. But our brothers and sisters out there are not as fortunate as we are. So we are now lobbying the Department of Education. We have actually prepared a list of assistive devices. As I said to you, I'm the chair of the ICT Forum. We have prepared a list together with all the different disabilities of the assistive devices that children in schools need. We are now going to ensure that when a child goes to school, that they are given these assistive devices to go when they start in school, and moreover, when they leave school, that they know how to read and write, they know sign language, etc., and whatever assistive devices they are given in school, they must be able to take it with them to go to tertiary institutions and to get employment, etc., etc. There's no point in getting the device at school and then leaving school and having nothing to work with, because then there's no sustainability, no continuity all over again. So I am absolutely involved and instrumental in it in every respect, because as I said to you, my work cuts across justice to education, to disability, to the law. So it's cross-cutting, and I'm involved in every respect insofar as that is concerned.
Thank you very much. You're the last one, no call.
Hi, Nokolo again. Ma'am, I'm sure you'll agree that the face of the oppressed and economically excluded in this country is mainly black, female, rural, and mostly young. Now, culture plays an oppressive role in terms of your ukutwala, your virginity testing, patriarchy that exists, as well as an economy that is stigmatized, quite derogatory and oppressive towards women as well, where we find tokenism, so-called box-ticking transformation with how many black young females have you got or whatever, and then it's just like, oh no, we've got these three beautiful black women over here, but they're not empowered to actually do the work or to grow in the organization. Also with land ownership, and certainly the education curriculum is, I think, might be problematic. Now, in your view, considering all of these numerous challenges facing women, especially young and black, how do you think you will be able to authentically or add value to authentic transformation and empowering women with the limited resources in the CGE? What would your priorities be? You started tomorrow and you would focus on what that contributed to authentic transformation?
I think the main thing that I would focus on is on public education. I think, quite honestly, it is so nice, you know, we have, as we say, all of these boxes that are being ticked. We have all the legislation that is there, etc. But if the people themselves are not equipped and educated and aware of their rights and of the Constitution and of the the cornerstone of democracy, etc., etc., because naturally we're so oppressed. It's those people. We very much according to culture. You're looking at. They're growing up in those particular circumstances where it's actually expected to be oppressed, etc. And I think if they're not educated that something else actually exists that's different, that, you know what, I am not supposed to be beaten. I am not the doormat. I can go to school. It is my right to go to school. There are other things that exist there. If they don't know it, but they only know what they grew up with in those limited environments, then we are never going to reach that sort of transformation. Because education is the key. And if we cannot raise that awareness among the people we're trying to bring up to par, then whatever we do from sitting here in the Commission for Gender Equality is not going to filter to grassroots level unless we educate. And as I said to you, it doesn't happen overnight. We have to advocate. We have to try and show people and involve both men and even those people in leadership positions, etc., to be able to break away from those particular stereotypes, myths, etc., that exist, and to say, listen, we have a constitution where we have human rights as the focus. And these are your rights. And that would be my main priority. And I would say that even with regard to trying to break that whole system of oppression, we need to have black young leaders who actually are there, who can motivate, mentor, and inspire people in their rural areas. You know, when you come out and you yourself break free and you have supposedly arrived, don't forget the community that you leave behind. That's why I always believe I'm doing so much of NGO work in the community, because it's well and good I'm the director in the Department of Justice, but if I cannot go and inspire and motivate and act as a mentor to those people who still haven't gotten to where I am, then I'm wasting my time. We're never going to reach that point of equality, and I think that is something that we need to try and show. We need to get mentors out there. We need to have advocates. We need to be able to have people promote. And we're looking at and women themselves. Because we must admit we have come a long way to it. We have also made certain inroads. I mean, otherwise we as women would not even be sitting here. So we need to take that leadership role as well. We need to ensure that the Commission for Gender Equality has some black young faces as well within it. So that people can see, listen, these people have done it, so can we. We can also break these chains.
Okay, time is up. Thank you very much,
Dr. Eli.
Dr. Ella. Eli, for honoring our invitation. Do you have anything to ask?
No, I just want, I'm 38, by the way. thank you. I just want to say thank you to you all for giving me the opportunity. I must say Blind Essay nominated me to come for this interview, and I filled in the questionnaire, and I thought, you know, if I could make an impact, then it would be a great place to be.
Yeah.
And so thank you very much for actually giving me this opportunity, and I'm sure we will work together going forward. And I can't believe that 45 minutes went so fast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a safe.
I was having fun.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can you please number 8?